In this issue of ICTJ's podcast series, we are talking with Suleiman Baldo, the director of ICTJ's Africa program. Today's podcast is about Ivory Coast, a country that is equated with a promise of transitional justice, which has two distinct transitional justice mechanisms in place. And we will be discussing where the country stands in this process and what challenges it faces. Mr. Baldo, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
The first question is on the background of the situation in Ivory Coast. If you could tell us simply very briefly about the conflict, but then about in more detail about the transitional justice developments that have taken place since the conflict, what the mandate of these two mechanisms are, and what the overall situation is.
The crisis occurred around 2000 when disputes occurred among political leaders as to who would be elected, or is qualified to be elected for succession of that president. The presidential elections finally took place in October of 2010. The first round was peaceful. The second round, which opposed then sitting president Gbagbo to Alassane Ouattara, was very tense, and Gbagbo, who lost the electoral vote, then refused to step down. The legacy from that conflict was so deep that the new elected government took a commitment from its first days in power with President Ouattara renewing an authorization from Ivory Coast for the International Criminal Court to investigate war crimes and atrocity crimes that occurred in Ivory Coast during the electoral violence. The government cooperated with a UN investigation commission into that violence, and I was one of the three commissioners who went there to conduct that investigation. Therefore, at the political level, there is real commitment for measures of accountability, measures of redress for the atrocity crimes that occurred during the conflict.
Can you outline the mandate of the two special investigative bodies that exist whether you believe they will result in legitimate criminal prosecutions?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because the Cellule Speciale d'Enquête, the Special Investigative Unit, had a mandate of investigating violations of domestic law that occurred during the violence, during the conflict. However, they have limited their investigations to economic crimes and crimes against the state. And they have barely looked into the actual physical violence and the killings that occurred, under the mistaken belief that war crimes and crimes against humanity are the result of the International Criminal Court investigations. Our technical expert, Mr. Luc Côté, explained to the commissioners and magistrates that Ivorian law, under what is known as crime contre les gens, crimes against the people, has in fact power to investigate crimes against humanity and war crimes. Why? Because crime contre les gens incorporate in Ivorian law the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture, against genocide. This led to a training by our team on the ground. We do have a small presence there, and they have appreciated this very much. They asked ICTA to follow up with the training on how to do a proper investigative plan and a prosecutorial strategy. And this is a training that we are preparing to deliver to them actually later this month. So Cellule Speciale d'Enquête is now better informed on how to also look into war crimes and crimes against humanity. The investigation they have conducted were flawed in the sense that, they announced that they exist and ask people to come forward who suffers from crime. So people who came forward, the 8,000 or 12,000 who came forward and gave depositions, were all the victims from, the exactions by forces loyal to Gbagbo. The victims of the violations that occurred at the hands of supporters of President Ouattara didn't come forward because they didn't feel confident, perhaps, that they will find justice. So you end up with, a totally unbalanced picture, which is perceived as justice of the victory of a sort. Second, those who came forward were expecting some compensation for monetary losses, like property losses or destructions of homes and so on. And therefore, no one complained much about physical, abuse or killings or maiming that occurred at the hands of their detractors, those who attacked them. So we are hopeful that the technical advice that ICTJ provided will help the commission to really make a better use of its mandate and address these problems. Likewise, in the National Commission of Inquiry, they did a remarkable job. They had teams of investigators that traveled to all areas in the country affected by the conflict, collected 20,000 depositions. And when we met with them in March to ask them about their needs, their requirements for technical support and so on, they had already finished their investigations. However, they were very keen to benefit from advice on how to write their report in a way that is up to the standards, international standards and best practices from independent commissions of inquiry. And this training for all the commissioners of the National Commission of Inquiry will take place now on the 21st or 22nd of June. So the commissions are very receptive and very responsive, and they know that, to really gain legitimacy, they have to be independent and they have to be fair and equitable in their in the conduct of their investigation. And ICTJ has facilitated that.
How do you see the process going forward? And do you think that there is any role for the ICC within the context of the principle of complementarity to play?
The ICC is, of course, a court of last resort. It prosecutes, investigates and prosecutes crimes at, the most heinous, at the most, level of responsibility for these crimes. And therefore, it can only go that far, by really addressing the top, perpetrators. And therefore, the ground is prepared for a proper environment of complementarity in that the domestic mechanisms have to really, address the other levels of responsibility for atrocity crimes that occurred in Ivory Coast for the system of complementarity to work properly. As I explained to you, the political will is not lacking. There is no deficit of political will. However, technically, the Ivory Coast doesn't have the experience of conducting investigations of international crimes. We are very encouraged by the fact that they are willing to review their practices and exercise and do it according to, international standards. The same is true of the Commission Nationale d'Enquête. And therefore, there is a chance that these mechanisms could correct their performance in ways that would be up to the standard of what is required in an environment of complementarity.
Let's turn to the National Commission for Dialogue, Truth and Reconciliation. Mm-hmm. This is a situation where we have these two parallel processes, one that we just discussed on criminal prosecutions and the other one that has to do with establishing the truth about what took place. Can you tell us at what point are we in this process and what are the opportunities here for Ivory Coast to benefit from this?
The National Commission for Dialogue, Truth and Reconciliation has been established in September, you know, de facto beginning of its operations. Therefore, it is fast approaching its first anniversary. And over the first year, and I mean, it has been set with very broad objectives, you know, about, you know, finding the truth and reconciliation and pardon and so on. And the objectives are not very specific about the investigative side of their work on identifying perpetrators and recommending follow-up to such findings. The mandate in itself is not very clear on what is involved with regard to bringing justice to the victims, you know, the rights of victims for redress, for reparations, and therefore the mandate is very problematic. The other problem around the Truth Commission is the fact that it's run through a very bureaucratic approach, and therefore they have spent a lot of time to develop their strategy work plan. The work plan is overambitious, focused on establishing branch truth commissions in the different, all the regions of the country, you know, the districts of the country. That's about 38, different subcommissions at the local level. Instead of focusing, for instance, to be able to manage the process more appropriately on regions and districts that were most affected by the conflict. The purpose of these subcommissions is to conduct, you know, popular consultations, and none of this has taken place yet. So they have looked into different aspects of the work of the commission at the planning level, but in reality, nothing has occurred. When we went there and conducted needs assessment in mid-March, clearly ICTJ could help address some of the gaps in their approaches and their plans, and we explained to them that we could be of help as providers of technical assistance and technical support for their work. Although we have discussed with them different kinds of support, and they agreed and said what their priorities are. For example, they asked for support in mapping the type of violations that occurred and how to identify, you know, the severity of the crimes and, you know, the perpetrators. My concern is that the approach to the problem of reconciliation is very much influenced by South Africa's experience. Therefore, the idea that, perpetrators will come and demand pardon and the victims will grant pardon and you know, there is no reference to what, victims are entitled to with regard to reparations from the state for failing to protect them, guarantees of non-repetition by demanding reforms of security and so on.
Is there any danger of the two processes, the criminal investigations that are underway and also, on the other hand, the Truth Commission actually entangling their mandates and stepping into each other's territory, so to say?
There is a real concern because these mechanisms are not talking to each other. The Truth Commission is a mechanism of investigations, after all, also. And they are not communicating with the Special Investigative Cell in the Ministry of Justice, nor with the National Commission of Inquiry. And in fact, ICTJ, during my last visit, which was 2 weeks ago, in May of 2012, to Abidjan, the Ministry of Justice and the National Commission of Inquiry under the Human Rights Ministry both told us you should facilitate a meeting for us so that we talk to each other and communicate. And we are going to facilitate such a meeting.
Tell us about the role of civil society. Civil society is always one of the primary actors in any transitional justice process. And from what we know, civil society is quite vibrant and lively in Ivory Coast. Are they engaged with these mechanisms? And what is their position when it comes to the transitional justice needs of the society?
Well, interestingly, all of the three mechanisms have been established, mandated without prior consultations with civil society groups. And that's why all three mechanisms have a problem of legitimacy. There was no broader inclusiveness, no broader consultation, despite advice to the contrary by all those who were concerned about Ivory Coast and met with the president when they knew about his intentions for accountability and reconciliation and told him to be inclusive, to be consultative. That didn't happen. Ivorian civil society is very dynamic. It has been a pioneer in calling for transitional justice measures. The first time we interacted with Ivory Coast was in 2008, when a local human rights group convened a consultation about transitional justice for Ivory Coast. That was at the peak of the crisis. And we sent two people from the Africa team to participate in that event and so on. And therefore, awareness of their own deficit of legitimacy is actually probably that what has led the TRC to hold a meeting for Ivorian civil society in the third week of May, jointly with ICTJ, Open Society Initiative, and the Office of High Commissioner for Human Rights in Ivory Coast. And ICTJ was, you know, in the podium together with the president to reach out for civil society and try to redress the problem of isolation from civil society. We are also helping there.
We have heard about the challenges facing the Ivory Coast in implementing the mechanisms. We have heard about the existence of the political will. We have heard about the lack of technical capacity. It is clear that there are many challenges, but what would you say are the opportunities for the society as it embarks on implementing these transitional justice measures?
Well, Ivory Coast is a functioning state. It's not a failed state like Somalia or DRC for that matter. It's an economic powerhouse, and actually Ivory Coast economy was the driving locomotive for the sub-regional economy of all West Africa. Therefore, Ivory Coast had the opportunity of a strong economy. And revival of the economy is key for stabilization of the country and for putting it on the right track for recovery from the conflict. This is happening now. There is economic recovery. There is political recovery, because elections took place in December of last year, legislative elections. They were peaceful, opposition boycotted, but that didn't impact, you know, the peacefulness or transparency of the process. There is a new government based on these elections and renewed commitment to revival. The challenges are enormous, but on the positive side, Ivory Coast has the tools and the clarity of where it wants to go, and I believe they will work hard on all these issues.
Thank you for being with us in ICTJ's podcast series.
Thank you.